The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the December 3rd, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing has a dark background, two men standing in it. The one in front is Kyle Rittenhouse. He's holding up the assault rifle in his left hand, looking into the camera. And behind him is Travis McMichael, one of the defendants in the Ahmaud Arbery murder case. He's holding a shotgun and also looking into the foreground. The title is The Vigilantes. Will the Rittenhouse verdict encourage more armed citizens to kill? That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Rittenhouse verdict divides the country. What happened? Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted on the five felony counts last week, ending a case that highlighted deep national rifts over gun rights, race, vigilantism, and what constitutes self-defense. After 26 hours of deliberation, the jury ruled that Rittenhouse, then 17, acted in self-defense when he killed two men and wounded a third during a chaotic night of protest and looting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in August 2020. Rittenhouse, an Illinois resident, went to Kenosha along with dozens of other armed citizens and militia members in response to rioting that followed the shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake, by a white police officer. Carrying an AR-15-style rifle he was too young to legally purchase, Rittenhouse stood guard outside a car dealership and then, after being chased by several protesters and scuffling with them, fired multiple shots, killing Joseph Rosenbaum, 36, and Anthony Huber, 26, and injuring Gage Grosskreutz, who was 26 at the time. Over the two-week trial, the defense called Rittenhouse a well-meaning teen trying to help a threatened community. Prosecutors painted him as an outside aggressor who provoked protesters by brandishing a deadly weapon and then used deadly force without justification. Rittenhouse sobbed on the stand and said he'd fired only after his victims chased him, hit him with a skateboard, and grabbed for his gun, and aimed a pistol at him, assertions backed up by some witnesses and video evidence. "I defended myself," he said. The verdict brought starkly divided reactions. Many conservatives praised the jury's decision, saying the evidence clearly showed Rittenhouse was entitled to defend himself and that he was a patriot who stepped up to defend Kenosha from a dangerous mob. "Those who help, protect, and defend are good guys," tweeted Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia. Shaken liberals expressed dismay. Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom said the verdict sent a message that armed vigilantes can carry around weapons built for military, shoot and kill people, and get away with it. Following the verdict, Rittenhouse traveled to Florida to tape a show with Fox host Tucker Carlson, who, it was revealed, had a camera crew follow Rittenhouse during the trial. Several Republican congressmen said they would gladly employ Rittenhouse as an intern, and Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican from North Carolina, said the verdict had sent America an important message. "You have a right to defend yourself," he said. "Be armed, be dangerous, be moral." What the editorial said. "Rittenhouse quite literally has gotten away with murder," said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "He put himself into a dangerous situation, goaded confrontation with protesters, and recklessly endangered others with a military-grade weapon no 17-year-old should be carrying on the streets. Would-be vigilantes across the nation must be jubilant, knowing they can go out hunting for violent protesters and then claim self-defense when they blow people away. This case should never have been brought, said National Review. The jury could see what a hysterical media refused to acknowledge, that Rittenhouse clearly acted to defend himself against three men who attacked him in sequence, including one who clubbed him with a skateboard and another who admitted in court that he'd pointed a gun at Rittenhouse before the teen fired. The verdict affirms a basic principle. Every American has a fundamental right to self-defense. What the columnist said. The Rittenhouse trial has shown us what happens when you mix racial and political division, gun culture, and self-defense laws, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. That same explosive mix is on display in the Georgia trial of the killers of Ahmaud Arbery, which also involves armed citizens who decided to take their notions of justice into their own hands. In a society filled with armed vigilantes, there will be more shootouts at the OK Corral, and it will become increasingly impossible for the police to sort aggressors from self-defenders. The Rittenhouse affair offers one clear and obvious moral, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. Lawless and violent rioting has consequences. While legions of haters have tried to pin the blame on Rittenhouse for being in Kenosha that night, the fact is that his victims would be alive and well if they hadn't participated in reckless rioting and threatened his life. Rittenhouse may have acted unwisely, but the onus of the night's tragedy falls on them. The law permits even a fool to defend himself, said David French in TheAtlantic.com. But an acquittal does not make a foolish man a hero. I'm a conservative and a staunch supporter of gun rights, but there's a world of difference between being discreetly armed for self-defense and open carrying of weapons as an intimidation tactic. Conservative hero worship of a misguided teen who engaged in remarkably dangerous and provocative conduct will only encourage others to follow suit. The inevitable result in our bitterly divided nation will be more blood in American streets. Controversy of the week is the Steele dossier. Was Russiagate just a hoax? If we weren't living in a post-shame era, said Jonathan Turley in FoxNews.com, these would be days of contrition and atonement for those who promoted the Russian collusion scandal. Special counsel John Durham recently indicted a Russia analyst named Igor Danchenko, 49, for lying to the FBI. Danchenko, it turns out, was the primary source feeding information to Christopher Steele, the British former intelligence officer who compiled the 2016 dossier alleging that Donald Trump's campaign was colluding with Russia to steal the upcoming election. We already knew that Hillary Clinton's campaign had funded most of Steele's shabby work, but Danchenko's indictment reveals that a major Democrat donor and Clinton supporter, Charles Dolan, actually supplied much of the rumor and innuendo Steele had claimed to gather from legitimate Russian sources, a damning fact that Danchenko concealed from the FBI. Steele's dossier was discredited long ago, said Paul Gregory in TheHill.com, not least by special counsel Robert Mueller, who found no evidence of the infamous P-tape, or Trump lawyer Michael Cohen's supposed trip to Prague to meet with Russians. Thanks to Durham and Danchenko, though, we now know the dossier was a willful hoax, one that paralyzed American politics for an entire presidential term. Notice the sleight of hand, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. By using Steele dossier and Russia scandal interchangeably, Trump defenders are trying to gaslight Americans into believing the only evidence of a corrupt relationship between Trump and the Kremlin came from Steele. That's demonstrably untrue. The FBI launched its probe into Russian interference before receiving the dossier, when Trump advisor George Papadopoulos began boasting that Russian hackers had obtained damaging information on Clinton. After Trump was elected, Mueller documented more than 140 contacts between Trump's campaign and Russia, and he obtained criminal convictions of numerous Trump insiders, including former campaign chairman Paul Manafort and longtime Trump crony Roger Stone, for lying about those contacts. While working for Trump for free, Manafort continued his long-standing contacts with Russian oligarchs and a Russian intelligence officer, Konstantin Kalimnik. He even gave Kalimnik campaign polling data. Mueller also documented 10 attempts by Trump to obstruct justice and thwart the investigation. Why did Trump engage in such a strenuous cover-up? He had plenty to cover up. The cover-up was ultimately successful, said Jonathan Chaitin, NYMag.com. Both Manafort and Stone refused to cooperate with investigators, calculating correctly that Trump would reward them with pardons for keeping silent. Mueller couldn't establish proof of a criminal conspiracy between Russia and Trump, but he found that Moscow did, in fact, interfere in multiple ways to help him win, and that Trump and his campaign welcomed that help. The investigation also proved that Russian President Vladimir Putin had leverage over Trump. Despite Trump's oft-repeated claim that he had nothing to do with Russia, he was secretly trying during the campaign to get a lucrative deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. The GOP-led Senate Intelligence Committee uncovered more bombshells, including evidence that Stone served as a go-between between WikiLeaks, Russian hackers, and Trump. And yes, the committee found evidence that Trump had multiple sexual encounters with specific Russian women while on business trips to Moscow, but that Kremlin could have used as kompromat. Steele's dossier may have been a fraud, but Trump was very, very guilty. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for free beer after environmental officials confirmed that a small creek in Waipo, Hawaii, reported to smell like beer, did in fact contain 1.2% alcohol due to runoff from a local brewery. It was a good week for gay men who earn undergraduate and postgraduate degrees at a higher rate than any other demographic, according to a new study. American gay men, said Professor Joel Middleman of Notre Dame University, had the highest college completion rate in the world. It was a good week for pancake eaters, with the announcement by the Quebec Maple Syrup Producers Organization, known as the OPEC of maple syrup, that it is responding to the ongoing global syrup shortage by releasing 50 million pounds of syrup from its strategic reserve. But it was a bad week for real-time reviews after a motel manager in Helen, Georgia, evicted a woman and her granddaughter from their room for giving it a bad online review. After Susan Legger, 63, called the motel run down on hotels.com, the manager called police, who told her it was within the law to kick her out and removed her. It was a bad week for the known unknowns after enigmatic Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema, in a rare TV interview, said she's always surprised when people say, "Oh, she's an enigma. I don't even know what enigma means. No one really does." Finally, it was a bad week for cosplay, with a 41-month prison sentence for Jacob Chansley, 33, the spear-waving QAnon shaman, who broke into the Senate chamber wearing a horned fur helmet. Saying he had no excuse, Chansley told a judge, "I want to grow beyond what it is that I was." And in other news short piece on this page, Biden set stage to oust USPS head. President Biden last week nominated two new members of the U.S. Postal Service's Board of Governors, potentially setting up an ouster of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. One pick would replace USPS Board Chairman Ron Blum, a Democrat who has consistently supported DeJoy's aggressive cost-cutting practices, including slowing delivery of first-class mail and raising rates. DeJoy, a former Trump campaign mega donor, appointed in May 2020, has been distrusted by Democrats ever since his policies slowed mail delivery ahead of the 2020 election. Removing him requires a vote of the 9-member USPS board. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said, "We have continued concerns about the Postmaster General's leadership." The briefing this week is titled, "The Pursuit of Longer Life. How long can human beings live?" That's a matter of debate, but some scientists believe 125 or even 150 is possible. What is the current life expectancy? Over the past century, global life expectancy has roughly doubled to 72.6 years. In the U.S., it rose from 39 years in 1860 to 53 in 1920 to 78.8 in 2019. To some extent, these figures are deceptive, as a substantial amount of the average increase reflects lowered infant mortality rates. But average lifespans for adults also grew in recent decades. There were about 95,000 centenarians in 1990. And more than 450,000 in 2015, according to a United Nations estimate. By 2050, there will be an estimated 3.7 million people 100 or older. By 2100, 25 million. A report by the World Economic Forum estimated that about half of the babies born in the U.S. in 2007 will live to 104. And the number of super centenarians who live past 110 has multiplied at least tenfold over the past 50 years. Why are people living longer? A combination of improvements in public health measures and medical advances. Vaccination has eradicated or virtually eliminated viral diseases such as smallpox, polio, hepatitis A and B, and rubella that used to cripple and kill millions, while antibiotics have turned once lethal infections into treatable diseases. Public sewage systems, chlorinated drinking water, and pasteurization have prevented countless deaths from infection and disease. In the 21st century, people generally eat better, exercise more, and smoke less than their grandparents did. And they get much better medical care, aided by major advancements in treating cancer, heart disease, and other potential killers. How long could people live? That's a matter of vigorous debate and a growing amount of research. The longest lived person in documented history was a French woman, Jeanne Calment, who was born in 1875 and lived to 122. Nobody else is known to have lived past 120, though numerous others have come close. Many specialists in the study of aging believe that the outer limits are fixed, that people just wear out as their cells accumulate damage and decay and the body loses its ability to regenerate. In a major study published in Nature this year, an international consortium of scientists concluded that the lifespan of all primate species have a built-in ceiling and that we are unlikely to see it grow meaningfully. The trajectory towards death and old age has not changed, said author José Manuel Alberto of Oxford University. Evolutionary biology trumps everything. But other scientists believe huge advances are possible. what do they envision? These scientists say that in the near future, we're going to see drastic changes in the lifespan, with people living to 125, 150, or even older. I have no doubt, zero doubt, that in the foreseeable future, we'll hear of a person who has lived to about 150, said Michael West, a prominent researcher on aging. The potential to extend the lifespan has attracted giant interest in Silicon Valley, where a growing number of lavishly funded biotech companies are investing in research that they hope will halt or even reverse the aging process. How could aging be halted? One idea that's garnered much attention is cell reprogramming, a method of rejuvenating body cells through gene therapy. Harvard Medical School genetics professor David Sinclair likens it to a reset process. In experiments, it's been used to extend the life of mice and even restore their eyesight. Therapies that clear the body of damaged cells are thought to hold great potential. Another intervention that's shown promise in animal studies involves treating the blood by infusing it with younger animals' plasma. Researchers are also studying the anti-aging potential of such common compounds as the diabetes drug metformin and the dietary supplement alpha-ketoglutarate, AKG. Mice given AKG performed 40% better in tests measuring frailty and looked much blacker, shinier, and younger, said a researcher. What would longer lives mean? For individuals, it might be appealing to push death back a few decades, but for society, much longer average lifespans would create major problems. Medical costs could soar if people live for, say, 75 years after becoming eligible for Medicare. Overpopulation would inevitably result when people no longer died off in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, creating even worse housing shortages and more greenhouse emissions. Successful anti-aging interventions would probably be expensive, so the wealthy might live decades longer than the poor. From a philosophical and spiritual standpoint, some argue that greatly extended lifespans would rob our time on Earth of some of its urgency and meaning. Would people become bored with life at 110? Still, the potential to prolong life and delay death has such power that these very real practical concerns are unlikely to stop the research. If you ask me, do I want to have cancer at 75, or do I want to be bored at 110, said veteran aging researcher Brian Kennedy, I know which one I'm going to take. Eliminating zombie cells. Many researchers are betting that the first anti-aging breakthrough will come in therapies that rid the body of damaged cells. As we age, we accumulate senescent cells that stop functioning properly but still linger in the body. Dubbed zombie cells, they secrete chemicals that damage neighboring cells, producing inflammation that's been linked to numerous diseases, as well as declines in cognitive and motor function. Researchers in senolytics are experimenting with ways to flush senescent cells from the body, and trials with mice have yielded promising results. James Kirkland of the Mayo Clinic treated mice with a pair of senolytic drugs, including quercetin, a flavonoid found in grapes, strawberries, and some other fruits and vegetables, and found they showed fewer age-related ailments and greater strength and agility. A host of biotech startups are testing these and other substances. Laura Niedernhofer, a researcher on aging at the University of Minnesota, says scientists believe they are closing in on a possible root causes of aging. I've never seen a field grow so quickly, she said. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week. First two are from the U.S., starting with giving a mob control over schools. The right-wing push for parental choice is heading in a disturbing direction, said Michael Gerson. In an overreaction to exaggerated claims that kids are being indoctrinated in critical race theory in all public schools, North Dakota recently outlawed any teaching that suggests racism is systematically embedded in American society and the American legal system to facilitate racial inequality. How do teachers operate under such constraints? The ban rules out discussing the zoning and lending practices that have maintained white neighborhoods, or systems of policing and imprisonment that have disproportionately targeted black people. Some evangelical Christians also are demanding the right to censor all sexual education they find disturbing. Now there's even growing opposition to schools employing mental health professionals on the nonsensical theory that students should be discussing their depression and anxiety only with their parents, who sometimes are part of the problem. Given our high teen suicide rates, banning mental health help is morally monstrous. In a liberal democracy, public schools should expose young citizens to ideas that might bring them beyond the views of parents. That's not indoctrination, it is education. Press freedom isn't just for professionals. Yes, the First Amendment even applies to James O'Keefe, said Jacob Sullen. Widely despised by professional journalists, the founder of the right-wing activist group Project Veritas is mired in a legal battle with the New York Times in connection with the FBI's recent raid on O'Keefe's home. The search was part of an investigation into the theft of a diary that belonged to President Biden's daughter. Project Veritas claims that the Times has no right to publish its memos with its lawyers, and last week a judge agreed, ordering the Times to cease that reporting. Times editor Dean Baquet rightly called that ruling a form of prior restraint and an infringement on press freedom. But in the Times coverage of Project Veritas, the paper has suggested press freedom only covers the real, quote, news media, not Project Veritas. It is true that organizations' deceptive sting operations, in which Veritas employees lie about their identities to entrap Democrats or government officials into making embarrassing statements, are not standard journalistic practice. But the Constitution does not distinguish between real journalism and Project Veritas partisan, agenda-driven investigations. The First Amendment intentionally benefits people we hate as well as people we like. This column comes from Russia. Slavs find brotherhood in gaming. Russians and Ukrainians may be facing off on the real-world battlefield, said Ivan Sirin, but venture online and you'll find them joined together in Slavic kinship. In esports, particularly multiplayer battle video games that pit rival teams against each other, fans from across the former Soviet Union get together, hang flags, and cheer for any Russian-speaking team, irrespective of its home nation. Our fervor isn't nationalist, as, say, soccer fandom is, even if politicians don't always understand that. In October, Russian President Vladimir Putin congratulated Moscow-based Team Spirit for winning the Dota 2 international tournament, calling them the first Russia squad to gain the tide. But in fact, Team Spirit's current lineup includes two Ukrainians alongside three Russians. Likewise, the Ukraine-based Natas Vincere has three Russians and three Ukrainians. Both teams earn millions of dollars every year. Gamers know it's not players' passports that matter, but their skill and ability to win victories, trophies, and prize money. That's because gamers and gaming fans are young, and their generation is more international in its outlook than their parents. They've carved their own space, free from national prejudice and political games. time for The Last Word, our in-depth article, titled this week, The Day the Staff Walked Out. Fast food workers have long put up with dismal pay and casual disrespect from management, said Greg Jaffe in the Washington Post. With jobs plentiful, some of them are deciding they just won't take it anymore. Dustin Snyder was tired of the low wages, the 60-hour work weeks, and the impossible-to-please customers. And so in early September, the assistant general manager at a McDonald's in Bradford, Pennsylvania, drafted a petition that laid bare months of building anger and frustration. "We are all leaving," his petition threatened, "and hope you find employees that want to work for $9.25 an hour." Nearly all of his two dozen employees had signed it. A few added their own flourishes. "We need a raise," one scribbled next to her signature. "Piss off," wrote another. Dustin, 21, could feel his heart pounding in his chest as he fed the petition into the fax machine in the McDonald's office, punched in the number for his bosses 80 miles away in Buffalo, and hit send. Another low-wage worker rebellion in a season full of them. All over America, people were quitting jobs at record rates. Even in a place such as Bradford, with its shrinking population and 30% poverty rate, low-wage service workers sensed they finally had a little power. Soon after Dustin sent the petition, the phone was ringing, and the regional supervisor in Buffalo was demanding to know who was behind it. Dustin's first instinct was to panic and plead ignorance. An hour later, he called and confessed, "I was trying to get better pay for my people," Dustin said. "There are better ways to go about this," the regional supervisor replied. She had been thinking about boosting pay at the Bradford McDonald's, she said, but she was not going to give in to threats or give up control. Because of the petition, no one was getting a raise. If the workers did not like it, they could quit. Days earlier, Dustin had accepted a job at a lumber mill that paid $11.50 an hour, or 60 cents more than he made as assistant general manager. But he did not really want to quit McDonald's. He liked his coworkers, who had become some of his closest friends, and he liked being a leader. He just wanted some affirmation and a little more money, both for himself and his team. Dustin asked his employees to gather around him in the kitchen. Egg McMuffin sat half-made on the counter. A clock on the cash register that tracked the restaurant's drive-through times and transmitted the data back to corporate ticked away the seconds since their last completed order. "Why would you want to work for a company that doesn't value you?" Dustin asked. He turned to one of the restaurant's longest-serving employees. "You've been here for 5 years," he said. "What have you got for it?" "Nothing." The workers, clad in their uniforms, ball caps, and non-slip shoes, stared at him, unsure what they were supposed to do next. Dustin explained that he was leaving and locking up the restaurant. If they followed, he promised he would help them all find better jobs. "How many of you want to go with me?" Dustin asked. Initially, there was silence. Then 7 of the 9 raised their hands. 2 who decided not to join took seats at a table in the empty restaurant. The rest tossed aside their headsets and abandoned their post at the drive-thru and registers. Instead of racing to serve customers, they began making food for themselves. Quarter pounder, a large fries, an iced caramel coffee with whipped cream and extra pumps of caramel. Dustin's anxiety, which had been building since he sent the fax, began to ebb. His coworkers were ebullient. "It's a walkout," one yelled as they headed out into the economy where low-wage workers, long accustomed to feeling scorned, ignored, and invisible, were realizing they suddenly had some agency. The discontent driving the Bradford workers and so many others had been there for years, an ever-present aspect of an economy that could be especially cruel to anyone without an education. The pandemic, the fights with customers over masks, and the fears of falling sick added to the strain. But it was the labor shortages, which extended to just about every part of the country, that caused workers' long-suppressed anger to burst into the open. Unlike the strikes of an earlier era, most of the walkouts included no picket lines. Rarely did the workers even make demands. "We all quit. Sorry for the inconvenience," read the message last June on a Burger King marquee in Lincoln, Nebraska, where, according to workers, the air conditioner had been broken for weeks and the temperature in the kitchen soared past 90 degrees. Sometimes workers left behind notes that resembled parting primal screams. "The staff at this location has walked out because we were being treated poorly, overworked, and underpaid," read a message from the employees of a Bigby Coffee in Toledo, Ohio. Often the dashed-off notes became hits on social media, passed along by equally fed-up workers. From the restaurant's windowless back office, Dustin called Stephanie Kelly, the Bradford McDonald's general manager, to tell her what was happening. Stephanie, 36, had recently accepted a job at a bank in town and, like Dustin, was finishing out her final 2 weeks. She'd spent nearly a decade at the Bradford McDonald's, working her way up from the bottom to the restaurant's top job. To join the protest was to throw away a reputation for hard work she had fought to build. To stay home was to abandon her employees. Stephanie was now deciding whether she wanted to be one of them. Like her staff, she had come to feel degraded and belittled by her bosses and some of the customers. The franchise owner had set the Bradford McDonald's starting wage at $9.25 an hour, while new workers at his McDonald's, less than 20 miles away in Olean, New York, where the minimum wage was higher, were earning $15 an hour. The low pay had made it almost impossible for Stephanie and Dustin to retain workers and keep the restaurant running. Stephanie decided she could not let Dustin and their day shift crew do it alone. She hung up and texted the night shift staff. "I want you all to know that everyone on the day shift just walked out and quit," she wrote. She said she was joining the walkout. "Effective 10:51 a.m., I no longer work at McDonald's," encouraged the rest of the staff to quit too. "I believe that you all are worth more than anything they're giving you," she continued. "I am proud of all of you, every single one of you. Whether you quit or not, I am proud of you." Then she drove to the McDonald's, where she saw cars backing up in the drive-thru. Most of the workers were gathered in the parking lot, laughing and smiling. The worker who had been with the restaurant for 5 years was sobbing. She had been swept up in the initial excitement of the walkout, but was now worried about finding a new job and paying her rent. She was terrified of losing her subsidized apartment. "We will help you get a job that pays better," Dustin reassured her. He and Stephanie were going to drive everyone to the Burger King 2 miles away, where Stephanie knew the general manager and the pay started at $10 an hour. Before Dustin locked the doors, he realized there was one last thing he wanted to do for his McDonald's customers. He could not find a pen, so he snatched a blue highlighter from the back office. "Due to lack of pay, we all quit," he scribbled. Through the night, the workers kept texting. On the text chain, they dubbed themselves the McRejects. "We'll be friends forever," wrote Matthew Arndt, who is developmentally delayed and autistic. "Remember my door. My heart is open." Dustin rose at 4 a.m. and headed out the door to his car, still clad in his camouflage pajama pants and a hoodie. A month had passed since the walkout. It was his day off, but he had promised two of the former McDonald's crew members, whom he had helped land jobs with him at the lumber mill, that he would drive them to work every day. Neither had cars. "Jesus, it's cold out this morning," Dustin's first pickup of the morning said as he slid into the passenger seat. "I left my window open last night and just about froze my balls off." Of the Bradford McDonald's workers who remained after the waves of spring and summer attrition, five had intellectual or physical disabilities that made it hard for them to find work at better pay. Most of the McRejects found new jobs for higher pay at Burger King, Dunkin', and the Save-A-Lot grocery store. Shakira, a 17-year-old girl who'd been kicked out of the house by her father and his new girlfriend, landed a $10-an-hour position stocking shelves at Crosby's convenience store and was living with her boyfriend's family. Matt and his best friend from McDonald's, David Putnam, were making $12 an hour at a Tim Hortons donut shop. The extra money meant David, who was raising his 2-year-old son on his own, no longer needed donated food from the blessing box near his house. He had recently even been able to treat his mother and stepfather to dinner at the Hunan Buffet across the parking lot from his new job. Matt's finances were still tight. He lived in a 2-story rental with 3 housemates. One had recently been kicked off disability. Matt was the only one in the house with a job, and he was using the extra pay to help cover her portion of the rent. After just 3 weeks at the lumber mill, Dustin got a $1 raise to $12.50 an hour, part of a company-wide pay hike. He hoped the money would help him finally afford his own place. For the moment, he was paying his mom, who was on disability, and his stepdad, who did not work, about $8.50 a month to live in his childhood bedroom. The money he paid helped to cover their rent and the food stamps they lost because of Dustin's income. Most of the workers in Dustin's section had been at the mill for only a couple of months, and Dustin attributed the heavy turnover to the tedious nature of the job, standing in one spot for 10 hours and stacking wooden boards. He tried to fight off the boredom as best he could by asking questions about the different kinds of wood they processed and how the different machines worked. He chatted up the forklift driver who had been at the mill for almost 3 decades and was making $30 an hour. If he could just make it to 3 months, Dustin knew he would qualify for a $300 bonus, a 401k, and health insurance, something he had been without for more than 3 years. "It's super easy," he said, of the lifting and stacking. "You barely move." The downside was the monotony, which was numbing in a way that McDonald's had never been. Weeks passed, and Dustin found it hard to stop thinking about his old job. He missed the friendships he'd built at the restaurant. He missed the challenge and satisfaction that came with helping his intellectually disabled workers master a task. He missed being a leader. About 6 weeks after the walkout, Dustin noticed that the owner had changed the sign on the restaurant's marquee. "Hiring starting at $10, it now read. The 75-cent raise was all that he and his staff had really wanted and all that they had been fighting for. To Dustin, it still felt like a slap in the face. His former bosses seemed to be sending him a message that their fight was never really about pay. It was about status and power, and proving to Dustin and the others that, despite their modest gains and whatever changes might be taking place in the U.S. economy, they were still replaceable. Dustin did not regret the walkout. He had refused to bow down to the big, scary corporation, he said. He had rallied his friends and helped them find similar work at higher pay. Dustin's lumber mill job would do for now. Maybe the meaning he had been searching for would come later. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a couple of short articles on the health and science page. Long COVID remarkably common. At least half of all people who survive COVID-19 go on to suffer so-called long COVID symptoms for 6 months or more after their initial recovery, according to new research. Scientists carried out a systematic review of 59 studies that covered more than 250,000 adults and children who were diagnosed with the disease, reports the Washington Post. They found that more than half of the survivors reported a decline in general well-being, resulting in weight loss, fatigue, fever, or pain. A fifth experienced decreased mobility. A quarter said they had difficulty concentrating or thinking. A similar number had breathing problems, and nearly a third were diagnosed with anxiety. Other common health issues among COVID long haulers include cardiovascular problems such as chest pain and palpitations, as well as diarrhea and lack of appetite. These lingering conditions were observed not just in people hospitalized with the disease, but also those who had no symptoms or just mild ones. One's battle with COVID doesn't end with recovery from the acute infection, said study co-author Dr. Patty Sintongo from Penn State. The benefits of tea and coffee. Drinking tea or coffee in the morning is associated with lower risk for stroke and dementia, a new study suggests. Researchers from Tianjin Medical University in China examined health data for more than 360,000 people in Britain. Compared with those who drank neither tea nor coffee, the participants who said they had 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day and 2 to 3 cups of tea a day, so 4 to 6 cups in total, had a 28% reduced risk of dementia and a 32% lower risk of stroke. The risk for both diseases was also lower for those who had 2 to 3 cups of coffee daily or 3 to 5 cups of tea. The study, which adds to recent research showing similar associations for ailments such as heart disease and Alzheimer's, shows correlation rather than cause and effect. And Lee Schwamm, chair of American Stroke Association Advisory Committee, tells CNN.com, people shouldn't change their tea and coffee consumption because of the findings. Enjoy your morning cup of coffee, and don't swear off additional cups if you enjoy them. And over on the Talking Points page, here's an article titled, Harris, at odds with the White House. A raft of mutual exasperation has opened up between Vice President Kamala Harris and the White House, said Edward Isaac Dover and Jasmine Wright in CNN.com. Key aides to President Biden have thrown up their hands at what they see as entrenched dysfunction and lack of focus by Harris and her staff. Meanwhile, Harris and her inner circle fume that she's being sidelined with thankless assignments, like stopping mass migration from Central America, that aren't putting her in positions to succeed. With tensions growing, the White House has been excluding Harris from Biden's meetings and public appearances. Insiders say the Harris team has descended into open panic, said Noah Bierman and Melanie Mason in the Los Angeles Times. Her approval ratings have plunged to 28%, and last week, her communications director quit. The first woman of color to hold the vice presidency, Harris was once the presumed successor to Biden. But should the 79-year-old president decline to seek a second term, Democrats now expect an open battle for the nomination. A few of Harris's woes are circumstantial, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. There is always a little tension between the interests of the president and his second-in-command, and her staff contains mostly newcomers and outsiders in Washington. Still, it has become increasingly clear that Harris, who ended her own presidential campaign after polling at only 3% among Democrats, is just not naturally politically gifted. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki last week took a familiar tack to defend the vice president, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, blaming her troubles on racism and sexism. Sorry, a vast right-wing conspiracy doesn't produce a 28% approval rating. Only Harris can do that. Harris' biggest problem is that the vice presidency is a terrible job, said Joel Mathis in TheWeek.com. Apart from Dick Cheney, a de facto prime minister during George W. Bush's presidency, most veeps become punchlines for jokes. Dan Quayle's claim to fame was misspelling of potato, while Biden's was using the F-bomb on a hot mic during the Obamacare signing ceremony. Vice presidents are enormously ambitious people who have to sublimate their own egos as they wait impotently in the wings and endure public sniggering. Sorry, Madam Vice President, but what you're experiencing is nothing new. Gosar. the GOP's defense of a violent video. In today's radicalized Republican Party, publicly fantasizing about murdering a Democratic member of Congress is no big deal, said Jean Guerrero in the Los Angeles Times. Just two of the 213 Republicans joined House Democrats last week in voting to censure Representative Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, and strip him of committee assignments after he tweeted an anime video that showed him killing Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, with a sword as blood gushes from her neck and then attacking President Biden. Gosar, who urged Trump supporters to fight like hell on January 6th, just before the Capitol riot, mocked the faux outrage over the video, which he insisted was just entertainment. Despite becoming only the 24th member of Congress to be censured, said Dana Milbach in the Washington Post, Gosar is being celebrated on the right, with White House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy vowing to reinstate him if the GOP takes the House in 2022. By excusing and condoning threats of violence, GOP leaders are inviting actual violence. This really is the cartoon Congress, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Gosar, who is 63 years old but acts like a teenager on social media, is part of a growing group of Congress members who behave as if their job is to become social media influencers or cable TV stars, as opposed to actually accomplishing something. Gosar deserves ridicule more than censure, which should be reserved for serious offenses. But Democrats are trying to exploit this episode to support their 2022 campaign narrative that the GOP is the party of inciting violence. Should Republicans retake power next year, you'd better believe they will monitor the Twitter feed of Representative Ilhan Omar, the Democrat from Minnesota, 24/7 for anti-Semitic outbursts. The GOP's celebration of violence isn't confined to dumb internet videos, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Take Greg Gianforte, the Montana Republican whom then-President Trump praised as my kind of guy after he body-slammed a reporter. Despite being charged with assault, Gianforte was elected governor last year. Trump has backed several Republican senatorial candidates who've been accused of threatening or abusing women, including Herschel Walker in Georgia. As Republicans defend thuggish threats of violence and celebrate belligerent misogynists and bullies, the slippery slope is not only becoming more slippery, it's getting steeper. We've got a few of the shorter pieces here. More than 100,000 Americans died of drug overdose between April 2020 and April 2021, according to the National Center for Health Statistics data, a 30% increase from the previous year. Powerful synthetic opioids, such as fentanyl, which is often added to other illicit drugs, accounted for the most of the deaths. Fatal overdoses have more than doubled since 2015. Only 100 of the 28,000 Afghans who applied for humanitarian parole, which allows refugees temporary residence in the U.S., have been accepted so far. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services says it's struggling with a massive backlog of people to screen. That backlog comes on top of the 73,000 Afghans airlifted out of Kabul by the U.S. after the country fell to the Taliban. Most of them are still waiting resettlement. As many as 1.6 million Americans have lost their sense of smell for 6 months or longer as a result of COVID infection, according to new research. Some may never get it back. We're going to be dealing with this for decades, said John Hayes, director of Penn State's Sensory Evaluation Center. Among childless Americans ages 18 to 49, 44% now say they aren't likely to ever become parents. More than half of respondents who didn't plan on having children cited personal preference. 17% cited financial obstacles, and 14% attributed their decision to the state of the world or climate change. On the poll watch, 43% of Americans approve of the jury's decision to find Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty of all charges in the shooting of three men. 39% disapprove. The verdict divided people along partisan lines, with 71% of Republicans and just 31% of Democrats approving. Among independents, 33% approved and 38% disapproved. We'll finish out the show with a quote from theologian Eugene Peterson, quoted in the Pittsburgh City Paper. He says, "Mystery is not the absence of meaning, but the presence of more meaning than we can comprehend." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. The W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.